love and truth. These are the hallmarks of the Christian life. Over and over again in our studies in the letters of John, throughout 1 John and in the first half of 2 John, we have had this repeated exhortation that the children to whom John writes should walk in truth and love. These ought to be visible in their lives. Their love for one another and their love of the truth that was proclaimed to them through the apostles. The problem, of course, is that there are many people who have a message to proclaim. And there are many who would assert that their message is the truth. If these disciples of John, if these followers of Jesus Christ are to be obedient to the truth and to love one another, they need to be clear on what the truth is and whom it is they are to love. You see, that is a question. Whom are we to obey? And for whom are we to show love? Is it anyone who professes to bring a message from God? Are we to give them our ear, our attention? Are we to listen to what they say and to walk in the way that they would mark out for us? Are we really to love everyone? Well, John presents us with instruction here that indicates that we are to be discerning in whom we are listening to. And we are to be discerning about whom we love. He tells us in verse 7, many deceivers have gone out into the world. Those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. These deceivers he describes as having gone out into the world. It's an expression that he used in his earlier letter. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 19, for example, having told his readers that the antichrist is coming and now is here, he tells them, they went out from us. But they were not of us. But if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out that it might become plain that they all are not of us. They have gone out into the world. Again, he repeats the expression in chapter 4 of 1 John. And in the first verse we read, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. So there are these people, these deceivers, as he describes them in verse 7. False prophets, he describes them in chapter 4 of 1 John. The Antichrist, both here in 2 John and in 1 John chapter 2. They are people, it would seem, that we need to avoid. And what is significant, it would seem, with this phrase that John uses is not simply that they have gone out from the church into the world, not simply that they have left the community of Christians and now are making their own way in the world, but it seems that they have gone out with a particular aim. They have gone out to make their message known. That they are not simply left the church and are minding their own business apart from the church. No, they have left the church and they have left the teaching of the church to go and proclaim a false gospel. To proclaim false teaching. And this is in stark contrast to the Christian way. It is in stark contrast to the way that was devised by God for the propagation of the church. We're told that Jesus Christ himself was sent by God into the world. And in John's Gospel and chapter 17, as John Stott points out, Jesus himself was sending the disciples into the world with the mission of making known the gospel. Chapter 17 and verse 18 of John's Gospel. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. You see, the reality is that the apostles were sent by Christ into the world to make the gospel known. And as the apostles planted churches and established congregations in different places, those churches send out men to make the gospel known. And so we have the Apostle Paul and his disciples, Timothy and Titus, among others, who go out and plant churches and establish the gospel of truth in various places around the world. They go out into the world proclaiming a gospel. Well, for every genuine, real, true, valuable thing, there is a counterfeit. And so we find it here. These deceivers have gone out into the world. And what are they doing? They're preaching. What are they doing? They're proclaiming a message. But it's not a message of truth. It's not the message of the apostles handed down to them. No, they have jettisoned that. They have adapted it to their own preference. And it is this that they are proclaiming there. A deceiver and an antichrist. There they are. They're out there in the world proclaiming their message. A message that doesn't have the gospel at its core. Not the gospel of Jesus Christ. Not the gospel of the Son of God who has come in the flesh. Not the gospel of the incarnate deity who came under the law that he might save those who were condemned by the law. Not the gospel of the God who became one of us in order to lift us back to our standing, our proper standing in the image of God, holy and pure and perfect. Not the gospel of a God who became man in order to die that we might live. Not the gospel of the cross of Calvary. No, they denied all of this. It's summed up in this shorthand phrase, they do not confess the coming of Christ in the flesh. But it's not simply the incarnation that they deny, as we've observed in our studies in 1 John. The apostle is referring to the whole gospel that is embodied in who Jesus is and what he has done. The incarnation and everything that followed. The incarnation and the reason for the incarnation. They deny this truth. We observe that they denied the reality of the effects of sin separating us from God. They denied the essential need for the atoning work of Christ on the cross to cleanse us from our sins. They deny the fact that God is wrathful against sin and therefore we need a propitiator, someone to come and to quench the wrath of God, so that we are free from condemnation and brought into a relationship with peace, reconciled to God. They deny all of that. Their gospel is one of live however you like, God will accept you. And with that background, with that reality presented to his readers, John gives them three instructions. He instructs them with regard to the danger. He instructs them with regard to the difference that it makes. And he gives them a directive of how they ought to act. Firstly then, the danger. Yes, there is a real danger. He tells them, watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Watch yourselves. Yes, there are many deceivers who have gone out into the world. They preach a false gospel. And no one is immune. No one is outside the possibility of being deceived by them. Watch yourselves. If these people, this elect lady and her children that we saw referred to a church in a particular place and the members of that church, if these people were so secure that nothing could harm them, that no false teaching could upset them, there would be no reason for John to give this exhortation. It's an exhortation that we need to take to ourselves. As believers in Jesus Christ, as followers of the truth, we need to be aware that we must watch ourselves. But today, there are many deceivers who have gone out into the world. There are still those who proclaim a false gospel, and sometimes that false gospel is very subtle. And we need to watch ourselves. Paul instructs the church in Ephesus in the 6th chapter to be familiar with the armour of God so that they can protect themselves from the evil one. He prowls around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And there's no one in this room this morning who is not in his sights. He'll look for any opportunity that he can have to sow a seed of doubt, to raise a question, to force on you a false understanding of Jesus and his work. And what's the result then? Well, John tells us that the result may be that we may lose what we've worked for. What's he speaking about here? To what is John referring? Now, depending on what translation you have, it may say, so that you may not lose what you have worked for, but may win a full reward. Or like the ESV, which I'm using, that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Well, in a sense, it doesn't matter a whole lot which way it's translated. There are subtle differences, I guess, between the two. But this could refer to one of two things, or both, in fact. Could it perhaps refer to a loss of salvation? Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we or you have worked for. What is it that they have worked for? Well, one commentator suggests that what they have worked for is their salvation. Not in the sense of it being a salvation by works, but consider what John wrote in his Gospel and chapter 6. And in verse 27, Jesus speaking says, do not labour for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you. For on him God the Father has set his seal." Then they said to him, "What must we do to be doing the works of God?" And Jesus answered them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." That you believe in him whom he has sent. "Watch yourselves," John says, "so that you may not lose what we or you have worked for." What have we worked for? By believing in him whom these false teachers deny. The one whom God has sent, Jesus Christ, come in the flesh. The work of believing in him has gained for us what? Salvation. So if that is what John is referring to, by listening to the false teachers, we could lose our salvation. It is a very real concern. Now, we have to recognize that if we understand this in the light of the rest of Scripture, those who are truly saved will not lose their salvation. Those who are truly saved will persevere in their faith to the end. They will be preserved by God. No one and nothing will pluck them out of the Father's hand. No one and nothing will pluck them out of the Son's hand. They will persevere. We recognize that to be true, but there are many people who profess to have faith in Jesus Christ who do not endure. They do not persevere. They are given over in time to false teaching, perhaps, or troubles and difficulties. That's why Jesus gave us the parable of the sower, isn't it? Well, it's not really a parable of the sower, it's a parable of the seed. And the seed which falls on different ground, maybe it's a parable of the grounds. And some of it, you see, falls on the path and nothing happens to it. It gets gobbled up by the birds. And some of it falls on stony ground. And there's a sudden bursting forth. But it doesn't last because the heat of the sun scorches it and kills it, because there's no depth of root, there's no moisture getting into it to give it life and sustain it. And there's other seed that falls into ground that nourishes it, but alongside it weeds grow up, the cares of life and of this world. And it's choked out and doesn't bear fruit. Now we recognize then that there can be a response in people to the gospel, but it's not a fruitful response. It's not a lasting response. There seems to be an evidence of life, but it doesn't last. We need to watch ourselves, lest we prove to be stony ground. We need to watch ourselves, lest we prove to be thorn and briar infested ground. We need to watch ourselves so that we may not lose what we work for. That is one possible interpretation of this passage. Another one relates more broadly, not specifically to salvation, but the reality that the New Testament seems to teach that there are those who are saved and who barely make it into heaven, and those who are rich in their fruitfulness for Christ. Even in the parable of the sower, we have the concept of the seed falling in good ground and bringing forth fruit, but differing degrees of fruitfulness. Paul warns about the danger of being so careless in our Christian walk that we get into heaven, but only just. There seems to be perhaps in John's thinking this idea, because he talks about not just losing what we worked for, but in contrast, that we may win a full reward. Remember the words of Jesus in Matthew's Gospel and in chapter 25. Where in verse 23, when he's presenting a parable of the way that different men have responded to the trust that their master has put in them by giving them different talents and the way that they use those talents for him. In verse 23, we're told that the master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." And that then is repeated with one of the other servants. The idea then being that we strive in our Christian walk to live lives worthy of Jesus Christ, of the sacrifice that he made for us, with the longing to receive that word from him, "Well done, good and faithful servant." The teaching of the New Testament suggests that not everyone will be rewarded to the same degree. But their reward will reflect the degree to which they were committed to Christ and the way in which they used the gifts that God had given to them. And it may be then that what John is referring to here is this idea that we need to watch ourselves so that we remain committed to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It may be that we are willing to take on board certain teaching that is more palatable to us. It doesn't necessarily mean that we are not fully trusting in Jesus Christ for salvation, but there may be aspects of the gospel, aspects of the teaching of Christ and the teaching of the apostles that we do not embrace. We may be willing to compromise in certain areas of holiness, of Christian living, so that we can live more comfortably in this world. It may not result in the loss of our salvation, as it were, but it certainly means that we're not honouring Christ as we should, and therefore that we will not win a full reward. Now, I think that John is probably referring to both these things here. It's on the scale, if you like. One end of the scale is the seriousness of the loss of salvation, as it were. And on the other end of the scale is the fullness of a reward. And you can be anywhere then on this scale. John is saying, watch yourselves, strive, work energetically for the full reward. Don't be negligent. Exert yourselves, to use the language of the Apostle Paul, to make your calling and election sure. Make it certain through accepting the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ and striving to live within its parameters. There is a real danger for every one of us. And then in verse 9, John describes a difference. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. It's a contrast that we've seen before a number of times in the first letter of John. This idea that if we fully embrace Jesus and his teaching, his person and work, then and only then do we have fellowship with the Father. Those who abide in the teaching of the apostles, they are the ones who have the Father and the Son. They are the ones who are in a right relationship with God. They are the ones who can have confidence that they have fellowship with God. Those who abide in the teaching of the apostles. In contrast to them are those who do not abide in the teaching of the apostles. John describes it as those who go on ahead. These are the advanced thinkers. These are the ones who have progressed beyond the plain teaching of the apostles, you see. They've made progress. They understand more fully. They see more clearly. They know more deeply. John says no. They've gone on ahead of Christ. They've gone on ahead of what Christ taught. They know better than God. They've reworked the gospel according to their superior knowledge. And as a result of it, they have neither the Father nor the Son. Whatever they may claim, they do not have God. They may have been popular because of the novelty of their teaching, but they did not have God. And so John comes to a directive that he gives to this church to whom he's writing in verses 10 and 11. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, that is the teaching of the apostles, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Now, we know that we are to love. We're to love our brothers. We're to love our enemies. How does that square with this? The Bible teaches very clearly. Paul is a great advocate of this truth, and we see it in Romans 12, verse 13, that we are to be hospitable. We're to open our homes. We're to welcome people in. Look at Romans chapter 12. And firstly in verse 13. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. And then in verse 14 he goes on to say, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. And he goes on through that passage to conclude in verse 20. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, isn't John contradicting what the Apostle Paul was teaching the church in Rome? When he says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, don't receive him into your house. Don't give him anything to eat. Don't give him anything to drink. Don't even greet him. For if you do, you will be taking part in his wicked works. His works of deception. Well, there's a couple of things that we must understand. The first is that John is not contradicting the Apostle Paul. Christians are to be hospitable, but there is a limit. And John is not saying that we are not to show hospitality to our enemies. What he is specifically arguing against is in any way countenancing the false teaching of these deceivers. They are not worthy of our hospitality. These are people who are actively seeking to undermine the truth of the gospel. This isn't your colleague at work who resists your attempts to evangelize him. You're to show him love. This isn't someone who is making your life miserable because of what you believe. You're to show him love. This is someone who is seeking to proclaim and propagate a false gospel. And you are to give him no quarter. You are not to acknowledge him. You are certainly not to welcome him. And so in a general sense, that is true for everyone. But let us come back to the reality that John is writing to a church. To the elect lady and her children, a church and its members. And when he says here, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. John may be referring to the way in which a church accepts a teacher. He may be referring to the fact that there is a responsibility placed upon a church to guard the pulpit, as it were, to ensure that those who come to proclaim a message are those who will proclaim the truth, this teaching of the apostles. They are to be watchful then, not individually, though certainly there is an overflow to that truth, but they are also to be watchful corporately. The church needs to take care. This was the teaching of the Apostle Paul when he met with the elders of Ephesus, recorded for us by Luke in Acts chapter 20. Verses 28 through 30, he says to them, pay careful attention to yourselves and to all the flock in which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to care for the church of God, which he obtained with his own blood. I know that after my departure, fierce wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And from among your own selves will arise men speaking twisted things to draw away the disciples after them. Therefore, be alert. It's almost identical language and certainly identical thinking to the Apostle John. Men will arise even from among you who will seek to deceive the saints. Therefore, be watchful. Do not even welcome them. do not acknowledge them as having any part whatsoever in the kingdom of Christ. They do not belong. So this means, of course, that we need to recognize that what John is arguing against is teaching that is contrary to the gospel of Jesus Christ. He's not saying that if anyone happens to differ from you on a point of interpretation, then you mustn't greet them, you mustn't welcome them, you mustn't offer them hospitality, you should shun them completely, lest by any association with them you may be perceived to be agreeing with them and therefore compounding their wicked works. No, he's not saying that at all. The point that John is making is that these are deceivers, these are antichrists, these are people who are seeking to draw people away from Christ. It's not true brothers who are seeking to point people to Christ but may have one or other aspect of doctrine that differs from us. These are people who deny Jesus has come in the flesh. They deny who Jesus is and what he has done. They deny the significant elements of the gospel. We are to watch against them, and we are to have absolutely no qualms at all about showing them the door and telling them that they are not welcome at all. Now notice that in contrast to this, in his final greetings, John says, "Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face, so that our joy may be complete. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him. I hope to come to you and talk face to face." Do you remember what the Apostle Paul said on one occasion? "If I, or even an angel from heaven, come with a different doctrine, do not receive it." And John is warning them, you see. He's saying to them, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, don't receive him. I'm coming to you. I hope to speak to you face to face. And of course, John will bring this teaching. But they are to be on their guard. The Bereans were commended in Paul's missionary journey that they didn't just take his word at face value, but they studied the scriptures to ensure that what he said was true. This is our guide. This is what we go to. And if anyone teaches anything that is contrary to this book, if anyone proclaims a gospel that is not consistent with this book, we must have nothing to do with them. Yes, we must love, but we must also exercise discernment. We are to walk, as John encourages, both in truth and in love. Not one or the other, but both together. Truth and love. And that will necessitate that we watch ourselves.